Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
I can't fly.
What?
You heard me. I can't fly.
No. You're going to have to do better than that, pal.
No, I don't have to do better than that because it's the truth. I can't fly. I suffer from aviophobia.
What does that mean?
Means I can't fly. I also suffer from acrophobia and claustrophobia.
Well, I'll tell you what, if you don't cooperate, you're going to suffer from fistophobia.
That's Robert De Niro and Charles Grodin in Midnight Run, an action comedy from 1988 that's either an entertaining footnote in De Niro and Grodin's careers or, depending who you ask, one of the greatest films of all time.
In other words, a cult movie. Midnight Run turns 35 this year. We've got a Sacred Cow review. And our African cinema marathon continues with 1987's Yellen.
That and more.
Why are you unpopular with the Chicago Police Department, Adam?
Ahead on Film Spotting. Welcome to Film Spotting, where we say, here's to libraries. Josh, it would have been difficult, if not downright impossible, to actually discuss this week's African Cinema Marathon title without our local library, and in this case, without that subscription to Canopy that is offered by being a member of your public library. This is a film from Suleiman Sisse we're going to talk about a little bit later that was a Palme d'Or nominee at the 1987 Cannes Film Festival. It was awarded a special jury prize, but you can't see it streaming on any platform, and you can't buy it on DVD right now either.
Kind of crazy. And yeah, Canopy saved me this time. We've mentioned it many times on the show, but the Chicago Public Library does not offer access to Canopy. So I
really
generally go with the hard copy DVD, but this time the DVD did not come in time for me to watch it. And so thankfully, Debbie works at a library in the suburbs and she can get Canopy there. So this was the first time I used it. It was seamless. I mean, it was as easy of a process, you know, as the Criterion Channel, honestly. So if any listeners have not looked into that, you likely have access to it, free access through your local public library. Canopy is really great and enabled this show to happen this week for me, at least.
No, me as well. And we'll get to Yellen later in the show.
We will also get to Midnight Run. But before that, if you've ever gotten any value out of Film Spotting by following along with one of our marathons, enjoying a Sacred Cow discussion, or just got turned on to a favorite film, would you please consider giving us a rating or a review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts? Those ratings and those reviews really help us reach new listeners.
Another way to support us is by joining the Film Spotting family. You get to listen early and ad-free. You get the weekly newsletter, and depending on which benefit tier you purchase, you may have access to our monthly bonus shows, really fun discussion with listeners live in August, talking about the Pantheon. More on that here in a second. And Sam, our producer, threw out today, maybe for September, we take a look at another current Pantheon title that's celebrating an anniversary. In America, the Jim Sheridan film is turning 20, might be what we talk about for our bonus show that goes exclusively to our Film Spotting family members, where you also can access our complete archive of episodes, filmspottingfamily.com.
All right, time to do the litmus configuration on 1988's Midnight Run. Is it the real deal or as good as a phony $20 bill?
Robert De Niro is a bounty hunter.
Your mother ever teach you how to talk nice to people and not shoot at them?
Charles Grodin is an accountant who embezzled $15 million from the mob.
It is truly in your best interest to just relax.
I'm totally relaxed.
I want this guy taken off. I want him taken off fast.
The mob wants him dead. The FBI want him alive.
I'm going to bring him into federal court.
Do I make myself understood?
These sunglasses, they're really nice. Are they government issued, or do all you guys go like to the same store to get them?
And his bail bondsman wants him in L.A. in 72 hours.
Josh, you know how presidents will often pardon a bunch of folks just before leaving office?
Yes.
Well, it's similar with film spotting hosts in the Pantheon. At least it was with your predecessor. What better way to commemorate the last show of a guy I was introduced to and only really ever referred to as Matty Ballgame than to share our top five movie character nicknames? Indiana Jones came in at number two for Matty. The Duke, as in John Mardukas, not Wayne, didn't actually end up on his list. But with that episode, both Steven Spielberg's Raiders of the Lost Ark and Martin Brest's Midnight Run were enshrined forever. Or forever-ish, as we're currently rethinking the Pantheon's purpose, process, and picks. I think it's fair to say that Midnight Run has always been the Pantheon's most head-scratching inductee. Sure, many a Gen X man like myself, Maddie, and Maddie's former Chicago roommate, show producer and co-founder Sam Van Hallgren, have always had a soft spot for it. One of the all-time great films, though, on the same list as The Godfather Part II, Taxi Driver, and Goodfellas. Run may not be as revered as that trio of films that also happened to star Robert De Niro, but it does hold the 95% on Rotten Tomatoes and also has the distinction of getting the Chicago Way seal of approval. All four of the city's major print critics at the time were favorable. In his 3.5-star Sun-Times review, Roger Ebert wrote, "Whoever cast De Niro and Grodin must have had a sixth sense for the chemistry they would have. They worked together so smoothly and with such an evident sense of fun that even their silences are intriguing." Ebert's best frenemy Gene Siskel called it funny, unpredictable, and refreshingly adult in the Tribune. Trib colleague Dave Kerr said, "Midnight Run touches on one of the great mysteries of the movies. How is it that the tritest material can come to life when touched by the right director and the right actors?" Even the Chicago Reader's Jonathan Rosenbaum was along for the cross-country ride. Mostly. Thanking the performances of De Niro and Grodin for turning this sow's ear into a plausible vehicle for a buddy movie. Turns out, the case of Jonathan Rosenbaum's Midnight Run reaction is as curious as the movie's Pantheon inclusion. Run's 25th anniversary in 2013 offered Rosenbaum the opportunity to reflect on his original take and on the presumptions film critics invariably make when writing their reviews. He offered four different exhibits. Here's the opening to Exhibit A, which he began scribing a few hours after walking out of the theater. "If it were merely a matter of script, direction, and technical credits, this formula cross-country chase comedy wouldn't be worth a minute of one's time, much less the price of a movie ticket. Martin Brest, who launched his career a little over a decade ago by leaping from a forgettable $33,000 independent feature called Hot Tomorrows to a $5 million heist comedy called Going in Style, followed by Beverly Hills Cop, comes on like a competent, if faceless, TV director, scoring with all the desired effects of his mechanical mise-en-scene, but leaving no discernible memory traces behind him. The script by George Gallo, a newcomer whose only previously produced screenplay was for Wise Guys, is as formulaic as they come, even down to multiple and periodic plot twists that seem to come along before every invisible station break. Danny Elfman's pop score is aggressively banal, and Donald Thoren's cinematography is thoroughly unremarkable. What this movie has is lively performances by two of the best actors in the business, Robert De Niro and Charles Grodin. Without them, it would be little more than a hole in the screen." The following night, he took a look at one of those Brest films he mentions, Going in Style, which led to a new reaction, Exhibit B. "While I still haven't caught up with Beverly Hills Cop, Martin Brest's other features to date all have certain traits in common. Hot Tomorrows, Going in Style, and Midnight Run are all mainly comic buddy movies with melancholy subtexts. All encourage their lead actors to ham it up, and each has an aggressive and synthetic musical score that editorializes and not so gently prods the audience, telling us how and when to react. Giving actors a lot of freedom while giving spectators very little freedom at all produces a strange push-me-pull-you effect reminiscent of certain popular TV series. The usual point of such shows isn't surprise, but the chance to savor minor variations on the already known. Not marveling at what Ralph Kramden says on The Honeymooners, but appreciating the particular inflection that Jackie Gleason brings to the line this time. This strategy, a triumph of embroidery over design, would be unthinkable without an interminable backlog of familiar lines, gestures, and attitudes, and that is precisely what lurks behind De Niro's role as a bounty hunter and former cop in Midnight Run." Rosenbaum's point here is that whether De Niro and Grodin overcome the film's limitations or are a product of them is something a reviewer really can't know for sure. A third possible review of Midnight Run, he then explains, might deal with De Niro and Grodin in relation to each other, rather than as some sort of united front that functions either with or against the rest of the movie. And a fourth could deal with how the movie works independently of what they bring to it. And that's when we get Exhibit C and D, which are respectively, Josh, his most generous and harshest. That negativity aside, any movie that prompts Jonathan Rosenbaum to pen four different reviews sounds like a Pantheon movie to me. But what say you? And which of his tacks will you be taking? The one that credits De Niro and Grodin for elevating undeniably formulaic material? The one that suggests Martin Brest may actually deserve some auteurist accolades? Or do you have a response so idiosyncratic that you might inspire Rosenbaum to get to work on Exhibit E?
Yeah, not sure if Rosenbaum is going to take another whack at Midnight Run at this stage in his career. We could probably jump right into the Pantheon question, but it might be more fun to save that at the end after talking about our reactions in general. And I would credit a little more highly some of those elements that Rosenbaum called out. Certainly not the strengths of the film. The strength of this movie is the star pairing. You would have to be blind to not see that. Even Rosenbaum at the very beginning saw that, despite his reservations. But I think he didn't give Brest enough credit here, along with the cinematographer he mentions, Donald E. Thorin. There is nothing revelatory here, but there is enough comic blocking and sturdy action set pieces to make those elements of the movie a plus. I think they bring something to this film. Similarly, George Gallo's screenplay, I was surprised at the level of sophistication going on here, even from a structure point of view. Think about how this has a very clever planes to trains to automobiles to walking on foot, circular motion, then back up that ladder again. Maybe not exactly, but pretty much back up that ladder with the nice little grace note at the end of Jack Walsh saying, "I guess I'm walking," right? When he's not going to take the cab. So that's just a little, you know, nice screenplay touch. And maybe we'll get into more of this in detail, but I think there's some interesting questions going on throughout the movie about what is the right thing to do? Who is doing the right thing? And again, that is a more sophisticated screenplay than what Rosenbaum described, to my mind. And one of the reasons that, yes, Midnight Run more than held up on this revisit for me. We've mentioned on previous shows how I have not seen it since probably late 80s, possibly early 90s. As soon as it started, though, I was taken back to where I did see this. It was definitely one of those at the neighbor's house on VHS. Wouldn't have seen it in my house. Just, you know, rated R at that point was probably not in general. I'd seen some rated R films. They weren't, you know, they weren't verboten, but this was probably not one that was going to get the pass.
A lot of swearing for the Larson house.
A little bit. This was definitely the neighbor's house viewing. And no wonder I loved this thing at 14. Every other line that comes out of a character's mouth is some sort of smart-ass comment. And very much like Brest's Beverly Hills Cop, which we talked about on the show, Adam, I also got similar vibes to the Blues Brothers in terms of this smart-ass quality. Both of those, middle school transitioning into high school favorites for Josh. Still enjoyed that element. Yes, absolutely. Does every line sing? No, I think we've already heard maybe one that, to my mind, isn't quite up to the quality of quoting or remembering. Fistophobia, kind of groaned at fistophobia this time.
Fistophobia is not one of the better lines.
I got to admit, but most of these absolutely land and particularly landed for me back when I was around that age. So an incredible pleasure to see this hold up in the ways we're going to get into. I'll pause here and we'll return to De Niro and Grodin because I want to give that its entirely own section. But for me, yeah, pleasant surprise that some of those other elements I think are worth noting for making Midnight Run what it is. I think the way I put it is that this isn't a movie that's the sum of its parts, right? That all those things make it as great as it is. But man, De Niro and Grodin, They make every one of those parts glisten just a little bit more so that it all comes out looking shinier.
Well, I'm going to take us there. We're going to get right into De Niro and Grodin and those standout moments in the movie that really do make this film. I agree with you. But first I'll say, no, I'm not going to have anything revelatory to offer as well, nor do I find anything about the filmmaking to be revelatory here. This is one of those sacred cows where it turns out I had pretty much the same experience with it that I did 35 years ago. And you know what? That's worth something too. It offers almost entirely the same pleasures, though I will say, and we'll get into this here more in a second, I will say that some of the pathos of the film is heightened with a little bit more maturity and perspective. And I certainly have a greater perspective on the acting talents of Robert De Niro and Charles Grodin compared to what I had back in 1988 when I saw this for the first of probably 30 times on television. I'm sure it was HBO. One other quick aside, though, I said there's not going to be any revelations, and there really won't be, but you mentioned titles like The Blues Brothers, and you think about Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, and some of these other films that are touchstones. I still also found myself thinking occasionally of a movie like Heat and seeing his Jack Walsh character is not that too distant from his Neil McCauley character. His code, his determination to do the job the right way. He's got an integrity about him. That man, Neil McCauley, is an absolute criminal by any standard, by any normal definition, but they share a lot in common in terms of their sensibility and the way they view the world, also in terms of their sarcasm. So that was something, I guess, that surprised me a little bit. But before those moments of pathos really come together, Josh, let's talk about the comedy. Let's talk about De Niro and how deftly he handles the comedy. And people need to understand, I think some folks listening will remember, you know, like when Analyze This came out and it was, oh, it's De Niro as a comedian, which I understand at the time felt a little different, maybe because of a recent slate of work that he'd done. But back in 88, it really was a case where I don't think a lot of people were thinking of the King of Comedy as an actual comedy. And sure, so to see him do straight comedy like he does here was a bit of a surprise. And then it's not a surprise at all that we find maybe the most talented actor of his generation is just as good with those comedic moments as he is with anything that's dramatic. And this is one for me that I actually have highlighted on the show before. When we did our top five Robert De Niro scenes, it was way back on episode 341. I had as my number five what is my favorite gag in this entire movie, and it's a pure De Niro moment. It's the bit with the sunglasses and Yaphet Kotto in the car. And then as he walks away with Alonzo Mosley's badge and ID, that little unexpected turn he does, like he's a Fed, like he's a G-man or whatever from a TV show, a crime TV show, acting all suave and cool, turns to absolutely no one and flashes the badge in this little kind of crouch position. It's hilarious, something you completely don't expect from that character, and adds this moment of levity and also sets up what is going to become one of the recurring gags throughout the film that always delivers. Every time Yaphet Kotto gets pissed because someone thinks he's not Alonzo Mosley, it works. Another moment of interaction between them, and it's another physical bit by De Niro that stood out to me this time, is when they're on the phone. I think they've now had to get off the bus, so they're trying to get Joe Pantoliano to wire them the money so they can get on a bus. They're on foot at this point, and he's getting very frustrated, even more frustrated with Pantoliano's character, and he starts yelling, and he says something like, "Don't start with me, Eddie. I will shoot him and dump him in the swamp." And they don't cut so you can see Grodin's face, but you can tell that Grodin makes a face like, come on, are you really going to do that? And De Niro, mid-yelling at Eddie, shakes his head. No, I wouldn't do that. I'm just kidding. And something about that playfulness between them and him even feeling this really tough former ex-cop, now bounty hunter, who seems to hate this guy for how annoying he's making this journey, he still has the instinct to tell him everything's okay, and he wouldn't really do that to him, which reveals something about his character. And I think that goodness and that innate sense of doing the right thing, which absolutely is a through line with this film.
I think that element of playfulness is crucial to De Niro's performance here, because you're right. This was his first pure comedy. If you, you know, action comedy, buddy comedy, however you want to call this, it's mostly a comedy. And he is having fun with that. It's not just that he can do it. It's that he's clearly enjoying it. And I think that's what the little flashing of the badge crouch is all about. Is you can see how that is a character touch, but it's also a De Niro touch. It's all about De Niro showing how far he is willing to take this in terms of improvisation. I would like to think, you know, maybe that was in the script. I don't know, but I do know that a ton of improvisation was at work between he and Grodin in their scenes together. And yeah, I think this is just where we see how much fun De Niro is having with this. It's also, as you're describing how there are flashes of other characters he would even do later, that's because this isn't, you know, this is a slight turning of posture of the kind of guys we mostly think of when we think of De Niro, right? He's not doing something incredibly different, but in a way, it's even more challenging to just make that little shift. Yeah. And yet, that small shift is why you get so many of the laughs. It's just, he still has that familiar grimace, right? But there's a little bit of a smile to it, or at least the smile has a little less menace than it would in his other roles, in most of his other roles.
But maybe, Josh, that's the only adjustment otherwise, because I think that's the secret
exactly
to him being so effective here, right?
Is
that De Niro isn't approaching it any different. He's not playing any of this as comedy. He is playing the character. He's playing the script. He's playing against the other character. It's all rooted in his character's behavior and his character's desires.
What did you do? Why aren't you popular with Chicago Police Department?
Something that really doesn't concern you.
She hurt you, Janet?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
What are you sorry about?
I'm sorry you're hurt.
I'm not hurt.
You just said you were hurt.
I'm not hurt.
You just said you were hurt.
I didn't say I was hurt. You said I was hurt.
I asked you if you were hurt, and you said, yeah, I'm hurt.
That's because you made me say. You're starting to put words in my mouth.
Jack, you're a grown man. You have control over your own words.
You're goddamn right I do. So here come two words for you. Shut the f*** up.
He is so good with Grodin. I mean, those are the scenes where things, Grodin is good on his own. You know, I think he's maybe offering, if you think about his persona, this persona of disdain, usually. He tempers that here with a surprising gentleness. So on his own, I think Grodin is good. But man, when they're together, and I think of two moments for me that are among my favorites. Look at De Niro's face that he pulls during that moment where the Duke is having an imaginary conversation between the two of them, and he's voicing both parts on the train when they've jumped on the train. And De Niro's face just goes from boiling rage to you see him being reluctantly worn down by the fact that this is so ridiculous, what he's hearing, and quite funny, that it gets reduced to this bemused simmer. And I love that in terms of just not even verbal interplay between them, but just how De Niro is using his face to react. And then the other sequences, we've referenced this as well already, but where they get to work with each other rather than against each other when they pose as agents investigating counterfeit bills in that saloon.
Witness and configuration.
They end up getting into this circular, nonsensical conversation about why the owner's nickname is Red.
Would you describe exactly what the last man who passed a $20 bill to you looked like?
30, tall.
About 6 feet tall?
6'5".
Dark brown hair.
Light colored.
Sounds like our man.
That's him.
We're going to have to take these bills for evidence. Make up a receipt.
This one's bad, too.
This one's bad, too. I'd like you to notify all the other establishments in the area of this situation. What's the name of your establishment?
Red's Corner Bar.
Are you Red?
Yes, sir.
You dye your hair?
No.
Why do they call you Red?
Oh, it's short for Red Wood. My last name's Wood.
What's your first name?
Bill.
Thank you for your cooperation, Bill.
getting to see them work together in that sequence, I think is just so great. But if you look at Grodin again, just what he's doing here, I was really surprised how he warms into the ridiculousness of the Duke. That first scene where we see him at the house with the dog, he doesn't really go for a laugh at all in that sequence. He plays it pretty calm. And I think that's all to let things build until the big blow up on the plane.
No, I can't.
Just relax.
Yeah.
What did I say? Don't pull that shit on me.
No. I'm telling you.
I can't do it.
No. Get over there. I can't. These things go down.
All right.
It's too big.
Of course, it's all an act. But before that, what is he doing? What is the Duke doing? He's watching. He's studying. He's examining Jack. And he's knowing exactly what buttons to push. And then even after that blow up on the plane, he doesn't stay at that level. He goes back to being mostly serene. I love how he receives Jack's physical threats with, it's almost not out of fear. He doesn't face them with fear. It's like he's disappointed in Jack. It's almost as if he's been told, like, they just went to an ice cream shop and they were out of his favorite flavor. That's his face when Jack threatens him physically.
Yeah.
He's slightly disappointed at him. And then how about the moment where the bank teller is telling Jack his card is declined and Grodin just winks. You know, winks at her, like, you and I are in on this. So yeah. I just, you know, Grodin, as good as De Niro is, I think the secret to unlocking De Niro's performance is the presence that Grodin brings in every moment. Every single moment, the patience he has, the not going for the laugh immediately, the waiting to see what will come to him in the moment. Back to your point about Jack. Because that's part of the Duke's character as well.
His patience is key. His intelligence as a character and as a performer in terms of his choices is also key. It's what adds interesting layers to these characters and then ultimately to the movie. And an example of that for me is to watch it and start to see, to your point about how he plays it, how the Duke watches, observes, takes in information. Understanding that even though he seems to be the person who is in a position of helplessness and Jack is the brute who is taking him in and certainly can control him physically, and he suggests that he's always in control of the situation, we know from watching Grodin that actually he is slyly determining a lot of this. And that's why there's a great moment when he says something like, you know, at some point I'm going to have to give you the slip, right?
Yeah.
And he's got supreme confidence in it. And Jack doesn't understand where that's coming from and thinks that's hilarious that the Duke would ever even imagine that he could get away from him, right? But we know, we've been watching and we know that he's smarter and more conniving than he seems and that he probably has it in him. He's gotten this far. He can probably get away from Jack, right? And so here's my question for you, as you think about all that, and sounds like you had a similar reaction to Grodin, his performance, when he says to Jack, maybe we should stop in Chicago and see your wife and daughter, when he hears about their story, is that because the Duke is someone who genuinely cares about that and would actually like to go down that path and maybe help people? Is he this Pollyanna figure that he pretends to be, that he seems to be? Or is he 100% just looking for a way to continue to get Jack off his game, to get him to take different routes, to put up more obstacles and prolong this entire adventure?
I think he's genuine.
Or is it both?
Yeah, I mean, it might be a little bit of both, but I don't think he sets that up or encourages that as his big opportunity to escape, because there are plenty of other opportunities. I got the impression more is the more time they spent together, the less the Duke wanted to escape. And there's two reasons for that. One is he's actually enjoying this relationship.
Maybe.
And the other is he might start to realize he's probably safest in Jack's hands. I mean, for as much as he thinks he's possibly smarter than him or can give him the slip, Jack has proven he can get them out of some pretty tight scrapes. And this might be, you know, just part of him realizing, I'm safer at this point to ride along with this guy as long as I can. I don't know, but I do think it is connected. And the reason I think it's mostly motivated by, good thoughts or a good hope for Jack and his well-being and his relationships goes back to this thing I mentioned about the debates they have about what is the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Was it heroic for the Duke to embezzle this money from a mobster and give it away to charity? Okay, but did he keep some? How much did he keep? Was that right? Should he have given it all away? Why is Jack pursuing this bounty? Is Jack doing it just out of, pure greed for the money? Is he, on the side of the gangsters if he does let them get the Duke? So there are a lot of complications here. And I think it came to a head for me in that very strange moment where it's like an outpost, almost like it's not even a town, but a Native American outpost they find themselves in, where there is, there's no way out here except for this small prop plane that the Duke finds. And so after that all goes down, they get into an argument here, and even Jack agrees with this, right?
Yeah.
When the Duke argues, it was okay for me to steal the plane because I was saving my own life. It was not okay for you to steal their truck because you were just doing that to make money off of my life. And it's just packed into and batted back and forth as funnily as all the comic lines as well. But it is that moment of clarity where you see they've kind of been having this argument the entire trip about every decision that is made. Is was this the right honorable thing to do? So, yeah, I think all of that, I see the encouragement to go catch up with his ex-wife as part of that for the Duke.
Jack, let's be fair about this. You lied to me first. At the river!
What?
At the river! Before.
Oh, get the...
At the river!
You lied to me first. You got some nerve.
No, you lied to me first.
You lied to me first.
Yes, I lied to you first, but you had no knowledge I was lying about my fear of flying at the river when you lied to me. So as far as you knew, you lied to me first.
Can't even argue with you. I don't even know what the
f***
you're talking about.
I agree that tension is there, and I mean the tension where you can watch it and almost feel like he's having fun or that he wants to stay with Jack and maybe even does feel safe with Jack, even though his life is constantly put in danger. At the same time, I never lose sight of the fact that it seems to sink in frequently with the Duke that the fact is, if they get to L.A., the closer they get to L.A., the closer he is to death.
That's true.
And so I think that for him, it's more about the fact that I ascribe total genuineness and honor in him as a man wanting to help this bounty hunter out and go have this poignant moment and maybe even a sort of redemptive moment. But at the same time, there's at least a percentage of it. There has to be a little bit of a percentage of it that is him just trying to come up with barriers, things that might possibly let him escape or keep him from death. And I want to give you one other De Niro
every
moment.
Every detour
too.
Does help him. I give you
every
that.
Detour helps every detour helps doubt, him. Right? But one other moment that I love from De Niro that I think also talks about behavior and the depth he gives to the character and the nature of their relationship and gives it even early on so much more weight than it could have. And this could be completely just my interpretation of it. You might see this moment, or we could look at the faces De Niro's making and interpret it differently. But remember the scene. It's the one where they're talking about going to Chicago and seeing the wife and daughter. I think it starts, they're eating dinner, or De Niro's eating dinner. He's eating that chicken wing. And it starts that whole conversation that really opens up that dialogue about like being in denial about what the right thing to do is and doing the wrong thing anyway. And he's eating these chicken wings, even though he knows that they're bad for him. The way that scene opens, though, is just silently with De Niro chewing and the Duke watching him.
Yeah.
And we get the sense that, he's quietly judging him, or at least quietly considering the damage this is doing to him. And the face that De Niro's making, the reaction, everything within his body suggests to me someone who is aware of that judgment and actually is a little bit bothered by it. He's someone who, again, comes off as so brusque, and there's all that bravado and that sense of control. And in that moment, it's as if he knows he's being watched. He knows he's doing something quote-unquote wrong, and he's a little bit ashamed of it. He would never say that. He would never admit it. But De Niro lets that in. He allows for that to be an interpretation of the moment. So I want to get to the pathos. And I give Gallo, the screenwriter here, some credit in that even if we think we know it's coming, that eventually he's going to end up on the doorstep face-to-face with his ex-wife and daughter again after that's introduced, I could see a lesser film concocting an extremely stupid ruse to get them there. And maybe some people watching this would say that is what happens with the shootout in Chicago and they get away on foot. Okay. But the fact that that moment comes, not because Jack has some big change of heart or all of a sudden feels like he has to do this, and we don't really believe that his character would do it. The fact that the only way he ends up back on her doorstep is because he truly has no other choice, that he is so desperate for help that he goes to the only person whose help he can ask. I appreciated that. And then when we get there, that interaction with Wendy Phillips as Gail, everything about their energy suggests and sells the history that they have and the feelings that have changed dramatically between the both of them, but that are still there. And I mentioned the head shake that I love so much that De Niro gives in that comedic moment on the phone where he lets the Duke know that he doesn't mean it. How about the four head turns that we get, those silent head turns that we get when he sees his daughter?
Denise? He got so big.
The way De Niro even kind of asks her name, when he says Denise, it's a question. He just can't believe that that's really her, that that's his daughter who he hasn't seen in so long. And that line delivery, you got so big. The hugs where he doesn't really know what to do. He hugs her like three times, you know, kind of briefly, as opposed to one big hug. And then her going back out into the driveway and trying to help her dad, despite the fact that they've been estranged. I'm not going to lie, Josh, it's Midnight Run and it got a little dusty twice sitting on my couch watching this movie in those moments.
I think that's a overall well-handled scene. I can't say it got things dusty for me. Maybe my favorite moment in it, though, is the awkwardness that they allow and give space for. And it's right mm-hmm. in that sequence you're talking about, in sort of the entranceway to the house after his wife has left the room for a few minutes. And so here's who we're left with: the Duke, Jack, and this daughter who, as you pointed out, he's not even entirely sure. It's been so long at first that it is his daughter. I think is Danielle Duclos plays the daughter, I believe. Mm-hmm. And yeah, no dialogue. There's like, I don't know, maybe 40 seconds of De Niro just kind of looking around awkwardly, wandering around a little bit, not knowing what else they've been reintroduced at this point, and some sort of conversation should happen, right? And it's not. And the movie just sits there and lets us sit in that. And that was one of those bits where it's unexpected, right? We know this scene is coming. I think it plays out, you know, as mostly we expected, probably, but I did not expect a little moment like that. And even Grodin is good. They're, again, patience, not going for a laugh. You're seeing his face in that scene, and you're also seeing how awkward he is in that moment. Maybe even thinking, I shouldn't have pushed this. This was a bad idea. I was hoping this would end in a better way, but instead it's become really uncomfortable for everyone. And yeah, it was brave of the film to let us sit in that.
Yeah. And here I want to go back to what you were saying in terms of what stood out to you about the substance, or I suppose one of the morals of this movie, or at least the moral discussions the movie is having. As I think about, again, De Niro's character and what's so effective in terms of rooting all of this in their behavior, at the core of this movie, it's not the gags, it's not the action, it's not plot or anything else. It really is character. And with character, I'm going to go to the film spotting word of every episode. it's about the stakes. And there are stakes, right, in that there are these time-driven stakes, what is ostensibly what this movie is about and what Jack's motivation is. Will he make it? Will he complete the job? Will he get back before the deadline Friday night at midnight or whatever it is? It really does, though, turn out to be, over the course of the movie, a story about integrity. And
yeah, that's the perfect word. Yep.
It's integrity.
That's what they're arguing about.
With that comes being willing to do the right thing, even in incredibly tough situations.
Yeah.
That's maybe the definition of integrity, is sticking to what you believe in despite the challenges and the adversity. And so with that, you've got these two men who couldn't be more different, but actually are equal misfits in terms of society and their professions, right? He notices that his accounting firm is on the take. The police force is on the take. They both end up on the outs with the bad guy, the mob guy in this case, Jimmy Serrano, really great, Dennis Farina.
Oh, of course. So good.
And so then the story becomes, actually, for us as viewers, it really becomes a matter of whether or not Jack will really be able to turn the Duke in at the end or not. Will he really be able to do it? And it's a legitimate question, I think, based on what we know about that character. And part of us even maybe wants him to, right? Like, I want Jack to get the money. I want him to complete the job. And the Duke can be kind of annoying. I don't know how I would fare after that whole flight scenario and getting kicked off the airplane, right? Be hard for me to forgive him for that, Josh, no matter what happened. But of course, we also want him to do the right thing because that's so central to his character. And so the way that's all fleshed out are these little moments that, again, I think maybe lesser movies wouldn't give us, are like the one where Jack is formulating the plan and Yaphet Kotto, Mosley, looks at him and can tell that he's getting almost giddy about this, which is something we haven't seen from the Walsh character yet. And he says that he's getting excited because he gets to feel like a cop again. You know, all of his behavior, everything he does, those moments of excitement, they inform our understanding of the character and ultimately those stakes. And, you know, our friend Sam, who has seen this movie even more times than me and every time gives it 5 stars, he had a nice little theory or idea too on Letterboxd where he said that even at the end, his decision to uncuff the Duke could be partly about, that's another moment where he gets to feel like a cop again. He gets to not just be kind of the automaton who goes and does the job, but he gets to make a decision. He gets to take the cuffs off of someone. And that it's really about, part and parcel with his integrity, is it's really about his dignity and the fact that his dignity in that moment has been restored more than anything.
Yeah, I'm so glad you landed on the word integrity, because I think that is essentially what they're quibbling over in almost every discussion they have. It's not inflated always, as it is in that discussion at the outpost about the plane versus the truck. That's where it maybe comes to the foreground. But even when they're quibbling over what he's eating, that's kind of at the root of it, is that question of integrity.
Yeah, absolutely it is. And there's another hilarious exchange where it's at the root of it. And I'll mention this in the context of another thing that I saw from Sam on Letterboxd that I didn't see until earlier today, not before I saw the film. In one of his viewings a while back, Sam said, and of course he did still give it 5 stars and adores the film, but he said that this is the first time that the ending ever troubled him a little bit. He said, I don't believe Jack would take the money. He said he's got too much integrity to use stolen money to open a coffee shop or anything else for that matter. And I bring that up because, Josh, I was so dialed into his integrity and these ethical and philosophical debates, if you will, that actually populate this movie, that it had never occurred to me before until watching it last night, that I had a moment where I thought to myself, I feel like Jack would give him the money back. I feel like Jack would actually be so against using money that came from Jimmy Serrano that he doesn't technically have any claim to, no matter what reasons he would use it for, or no matter how bad the guy is, right, that he's taking it from, ultimately in Serrano, he would never actually use it. He would never take it. And the movie suggests that this is kind of his redemption, this restoration of dignity at the end. It's partly when he gets this money as well. And for me, I guess ultimately the way I came to justify it, or think it works in terms of the story and character, not just in terms of the movie getting a happy ending that we all get to smile about, is remember the conversation where they're arguing about who lied to who first?
Yeah.
And the Duke's entire point is that he didn't know at the time he was lying when he lied to him on the water about the fact that the Duke actually is just fine with flying and in fact has the ability to fly. He didn't know that. He doesn't know it till later. The implication, the idea being, right, that what you do, what your choices say about you in the moment with the information you have at your disposal, that's what really matters, not ultimately how it shakes out. What matters is what you do in the moment. And in that moment, he has already decided to let the Duke go. He has no expectation in that moment that he is going to be rewarded financially for it at all. He is prepared to walk away and never see that guy again or reap any benefits. And in fact, he's missing out on $100,000 that he has more than earned. He's actually
This is at the end you're talking about.
Yeah. He's actually losing money. But because he's getting rewarded for something he'd already decided to do and had made the right decision based on that, not motivated by the money, I think he can justify it for himself as well.
That's it. That's what, as you were talking, I was trying to remember. And it's been like a week since I've seen it again. There's a caveat. There was a little detail that takes place, and that's it. That's what you described. That's why it is.
Take it. You already let me go.
Yes. That's why it fits with this whole understanding of integrity, why it's okay for him to take the money. That's what it is. That's why it works for me, at least.
Yeah. So lastly, just how about Midnight Run being one of those all-time that guy movies? We've already mentioned it a little bit with Dennis Farina showing up as Serrano, but as Serrano and Yaphet Kotto as Alonzo Mosley. I love seeing John Ashton again. And I say again, because we did talk about him and his relationship with Axel Foley in Beverly Hills Cop, the other Martin Brest film. Joe Pantoliano, again, I didn't know this until Sam mentioned it on Twitter today, but it's insane that there have been three movies in a row talked about on the show, and he's been in all of them.
Joey Pants, I think we're supposed to call him. It's been my month of Joey Pants between Risky Business, The Fugitive, back with Michael Phillips, and now this in Midnight Run. And the other thing, you know, you mentioned how De Niro here made you think about De Niro and Heat. How about Philip Baker Hall here?
His name's making Sydney. Me think
his name's Sydney. So I did a quick Google search and couldn't nail it down, but it does seem to be the case that in Paul Thomas Anderson's Heart 8, he's supposed to be the same character.
That's so funny that you looked it up, because I had the same thought. I'm like, could this really be a coincidence? And maybe I just ran out of time, but I decided not to even search for it. I was like, of course it's a coincidence. It just has to be, but it probably isn't.
It probably isn't, is what I'm going to say. I gave it probably 5 to 8 minutes, and then I was like, I got to move on with my day. So I don't have it definitively anywhere that PTA said this. Maybe that's out there somewhere and a listener knows. But yeah, he's a mob advisor here. That would track, right, with the sort of mysterious Sydney's past in Heart 8. And I think that's, even if it's not the case, it's lovely that it works out that way.
Midnight Run, the number 26 film at the domestic box office in 1988. That puts it in the same company as the re-release of Bambi, the final film in Clint Eastwood's Dirty Harry series, The Deadpool, and the original Child's Play movie. Because we are at the end of this conversation, and we did set it up with some stakes of our own, ultimately being a referendum of sorts on Midnight Run in the Pantheon, I suppose we have to give listeners a sense of where our heads are at vis-a-vis that question. Now, for people who have heard the bonus show where we really got into the details of how we're envisioning this potentially going, part of the deal is we wouldn't have to make any decisions in the moment. These films that we've discussed, the Sacred Cow movies we talk about on their anniversaries, if we are favorable about them, they would go into a pool to be voted on at a certain time every year. We'd have finalists, if you will, kind of like a Hall of Fame. And then we'd have a class that would get in. But this is the one that's kicking off all of that conversation. And since Midnight Run is the weirdest entry in the Pantheon, we're going to have to answer it. Where do you fall on the Pantheon question, yay or nay?
Yeah, we're looking at eventually some sort of voting process. But the point is, you and I will each have to vote. So is it Pantheon eligible, I guess, is what we're trying to decide right now. Here's where I'm at. Absolutely held up, in some ways better than I expected. Honest truth, if I were putting a Martin Brest film in the Pantheon, it would be Beverly Hills Cop. It just would. It's one that I have more affection for. I probably laugh at more. And I think, despite all the stuff we dug out here, has a lot of interesting racial subtext and really right on the tech stuff going on that I just think is more compelling. So those two movies just being next to each other, it would be hard for me to put in Midnight Run ahead of that. But I have a proposal. Let me hear your vote, and then I have a proposal for you.
Well, I'm going to have it both ways here, in the sense that I also thought about it in relation to Beverly Hills Cop. And the fact is, although I really do like that film quite a bit, I like Midnight Run. I have more affection for Midnight Run, and I'm going to rate it slightly higher. And so another thing we discussed is, for them to be Pantheon eligible, they maybe have to get at least 4.5 stars out of 5 when we rate them on Letterboxd. And right now, Midnight Run is going to get 4.5 stars for me. So it's Pantheon eligible. Now, where I really thought you were going to go with Martin Brest is just more, am I really going to put a Martin Brest film in the Pantheon before maybe, I don't know, an Agnès Varda film or even Godard film or anyone else who's not French, whatever, doesn't matter. I was thinking about it a little bit more in those terms, and it's hard for me to put Midnight Run above certain other films. But is it eligible on its own?
Yeah.
I may not vote for it. If we come down to a list of 6 to 8, it may not make my top 3, but I think it should be in the 6 to 8.
All right. So here's my proposal, thinking about this and restructuring the Pantheon. I think this is a perfect movie for helping us distinguish between best and favorite. Even if someone thinks it's very good, it may not be one of their favorites, or vice versa. You may think it's not Pantheon movie, but it is one of your favorites. Okay. So I'm wondering, proposal here, if we consider giving each host in the show's history one quote unquote favorite to put in the Pantheon. So this could possibly be Maddie Ballgames. I don't know. We'd have to see. Maybe Sam wants to claim this one. Perhaps I might go with something like Cedar Rapids, which I know would not get the vote from anyone else. Or secondary proposal. This one I think you're going to like even better because it's more complicated. What if we establish a wing in the Pantheon for each host? We have the Sam wing, the Maddie wing.
Yeah.
Okay. And then, wait, gets better. Maybe we each get 5 shelves in our wing.
Okay.
And so it's not just one you have to pick. And then you and I at some point can do a top 5 personal favorite movies. That'll fill our slots in the Pantheon. We could talk to Sam, talk to Maddie, how they want to fill theirs. But I do like this idea as we're moving forward. One of the things that came up in the Film Spotting Advisory Board meeting, that is the bonus show you mentioned, is not wanting to lose the idiosyncratic flavor of the Pantheon as it is now. And we're trying to reconcile Midnight Run next to Padre Panchali.
Yes.
Maybe that's not a problem. Okay. I like this enough that I'm not going to try to prevent it from getting into the Pantheon. Would I personally put it in there? No. But I do think it's a good example of maybe it's someone's personal pick. Maybe it's the first slot in their wing. I don't know. We've got a lot of discussion to do, but that's what I was thinking after watching Midnight Run.
I love it when Josh gets in the idea business. We will discuss those ideas and more on many a future Film Spotting production meeting, and then we'll turn those into probably on-air production meetings so we can get input from all of you, our valued listeners. Midnight Run is currently available on Netflix and VOD. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, maybe you want to make the case that, no, it doesn't need to be part of a separate wing. It just absolutely belongs in the Pantheon with Padre Panchali. Great. Email us. Let us know. feedback@filmspotting.net.
That's what I love about these high school girls, man. I get older, they stay the same age.
The 50s were boring. The 60s rocked. The 70s, oh my God, they obviously suck.
dazed and confused. See it with a bud.
Behind every good man.
I don't know, Josh, is it fair to assume that back in 93, when we were both seeing Dazed and Confused for the first time, we weren't seeing it with a bud?
Yes, safe to say, not in 93.
Though, I actually didn't even see Dazed and Confused in the theater. I didn't see it when it came out. It was a much later viewing on home video.
Okay. I had to have, but I don't have a distinct memory of it. I don't know why I wouldn't have in 93.
Dazed does turn 30 this year, like Midnight Run. It's a film that is in the film spotting pantheon, which we have somehow never given the sacred cow treatment to. And also, like Midnight Run, it's a film that probably few would have predicted would have any staying power 3 decades later. It never played on more than a couple hundred screens. It made $8 million in its brief theatrical run. And yet it is a movie that many of us come back to. Some of us come back to again and again for top five lists. It doesn't have a lot in common with Midnight Run otherwise, but they do share a few qualities, Josh. I mean, if you're going to talk about a That Guy kind of Hall of Fame movie, well, here we get That Guy and That Girl Hall of Fame with McConaughey and Affleck and Parker Posey and Joey Lauren Adams, Adam Goldberg. The names just keep coming in this ensemble. And I'm going to say, sorry, Sam, it's even more quotable than Midnight Run.
Oh, wow. That's going to... Yeah. I don't know how that's going to land.
I don't know how it will either. He's going to be mad. So next week, a Sacred Cow review of Dazed and Confused. If you're wondering, no, we don't think there's anything we want to talk about really at the box office this week or in coming weeks. Nothing that would be as much fun or hopefully rewarding as Dazed and Confused anyway. We will also have results from the current deeply flawed film spotting poll asking you to save one and only one Linklater film. Yes, Dazed is among the options, but so are Before Sunrise and Sunset and Boyhood. And for some reason, School of Rock.
Just leave School of Rock alone. Why?
I can't help it.
Why are you choosing to be a bully over School of Rock?
You're right. I'm making a case for Midnight Run being in the pantheon. Let's put School of Rock in there, too.
Just open the doors wide.
Yeah, let's do it. Currently in the lead, maybe a little surprising to me, Dazed and Confused. You can vote in that poll and leave a comment at filmspotting.net. Next week, we are also planning to wrap up our African cinema marathon with 2017's I Am Not a Witch. So I got to do the math here. We're jumping ahead, what, 30 years to come from Yellen?
Sounds about right.
1987. We are going to talk about this film from a Zambian Welsh director, Rungano Nyoni, and we're hoping to get in our marathon awards. This is where we wrap up a marathon. We give our picks for favorite performance, for best picture, few other categories. We like to always have at least one special category, something unique to the marathon. And we like to come up with a marathon award name. Often we take advice on the category and the name from our listeners, Josh. I'm hoping we get some good ones. Feedback at filmspotting.net. I know people are following along.
Yeah, it's great to see these titles popping up on Letterboxd among names we recognize as listeners, especially for a couple of these, you know, a little harder to find titles. So thanks to those who are doing that with us.
I'm Not a Witch is currently streaming and on demand on many platforms, so easier to see, hopefully, for all of us than this week's movie. But we also do encourage you to try your library for a DVD copy or to get it via Canopy. More information about the marathon is available at filmspotting.net. Just click on marathons. And of course, if you do have any feedback or suggestions for us, once again, our email is feedback@filmspotting.net.
This week on our sister podcast, The Next Picture Show, it's part two of their click, click, boom pairing. My hat's off to you, Genevieve, if you...
Total hats off.
You named that one. They're looking at Emma Seligman's Bottoms alongside 1988's Heathers and just finished this episode, this part two today. And I will say, if there are any of you out there who are not totally taken with Bottoms, some interesting discussion and pushback actually from the hosts on this episode of The Next Picture Show.
Is Tasha the one doing the pushback?
You know, it's
arguing
not.
Arguing with Scott.
It's not. Just Tasha, I would say. Surprisingly, I think, you know, there are fans among the group as well. But yeah, you know, I was pretty high on it with Mariah Gates on this show. And so if you're looking for a little different take, do check out The Next Picture Show. Your hosts there are Tasha Robinson, Keith Phipps, Scott Tobias, and Genevieve Kosky. New episodes post every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts, and you can get more information at nextpictureshow.net. It is time now for Massacre Theater, the part of the show where we perform a scene, and you get a chance to win a film spotting t-shirt. A couple weeks back, guest host Mariah and I massacred this scene.
The 1961 Ferrari 250 GT, California. Less than 100 were made. My father spent 3 years restoring this car. It is his love. It is his passion.
It is his fault he didn't lock the garage.
Ferris, what are you talking about?
More beautiful.
Ferris, my father loves this car more than life itself.
A man with priorities so far out of whack doesn't deserve such a fine automobile.
That was
Alan Ruck and Matthew Broderick in 1986's Ferris Bueller's Day Off, written and directed by John Hughes. That massacre, part of the show when Mariah and I reviewed Emma Seligman's Bottoms, along with a Sacred Cow review of Risky Business. So, why that scene from Ferris Bueller?
Well, many members of the trivia spotting mafia in the New York City area all weighed in this week, Josh, with answers. Ben Collar in East Brunswick, New Jersey says, first of all, love the use of the name Abe as a substitute for Ferris. Of course, a reference to Abe Froman, the Sausage King of Chicago. Some connections. First, the obvious. Both Bueller and Risky Business are Chicagoland-based teen comedies. Good job with the use of Chicagoland there too, Ben. Both films include parents obsessed with objects, Cameron's dad's car in the Massacre Theater scene, and Joel's mom's egg in Risky Business. Both films also include iconic song and dance scenes that for many certain generations have completely taken over our minds when we hear the song. When we hear Twist and Shout, we think of Ferris Bueller. When we hear old-time rock and roll, we think of Risky Business. Beyond this week's episode, Ben was on to this. Joey Pants plays Guido in Risky Business and also appeared in last week's The Fugitive. Again, the scene you massacred and much of the film is centered around a big old fancy car, as is this week's new release, Gran Turismo. Yeah, that's what we were thinking about.
I think that one slipped past us. Nice work there, Ben. Here's Ross Bratton in New York City. I, of course, knew what scene was being massacred by Josh and Mariah instantly. It's Ferris Bueller's Day Off. That scene is a great one, and Josh nailed the delivery of Cameron's "It is his love, it is his passion." Oh, thank you, Ross. There are obviously several connections to this week's episode. First, Ferris is a classic 80s teen comedy, just like Risky Business. Similar to Bottoms, Ferris Bueller takes place in a heightened existence. I mean, only in the world of Ferris Bueller would a high school senior be out sick for one day and a town put a message on the local water tower to save him. Ferris Bueller also co-stars Mia Sara, who the year before co-starred with Risky Business's Tom Cruise in Legend. Legend was directed by Ridley Scott, whose Napoleon is one of the options in the new poll question. And on a personal connection, Ferris Bueller's Day Off and Emma Seligman and Rachel Sennett's first feature, Shiva Baby, are two of my all-time favorite films.
And here's Bailey from Bill Ricka, Mass. The obvious tie-in is it falls into the high school shenanigans genre of films that also included both Bottoms and Risky Business, which were reviewed in the episode. Bueller and Business are also both set in Chicago. However, the best tie-in is the film spotting family's own Ross Bratton, Bueller being his favorite film, and Bottom starring Rachel Sennett, his favorite human.
Very nice. All right. I like how these folks know each other so well. They're so able to reference their connections. One more here from Danilo Koval, perhaps, hopefully, from Berlin, Germany. This is the first time ever that I've guessed the movie you've played a scene from in Massacre Theater. I immediately felt a connection with Risky Business, which also features a prominent scene with a parent's luxury car.
Yeah, I like that Ben, of course, noted that we've got the obsession with a car and we've got an obsession with the egg. But he did seem to overlook, amidst all those other connections, that both also have dads obsessed with vehicles.
Porsche.
There's no substitute.
There you go.
Reach into the pretty brimming film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner, Josh.
Our winner is Jillian Pecoraro, who is apparently the Sausage King of Chicago, though currently residing in Pocahontas, Arkansas.
Yeah, I think that's where you go after you've made all your millions in sausage in Chicago. You go to Pocahontas, Arkansas. Congratulations, Jillian. Email feedback at filmspotting.net to claim your film spotting t-shirt, your tote bag, or We will be happy to give you a trial membership in the Film Spotting family. If you're not already a member, get access to the full archive, get access to bonus shows, filmspottingfamily.com, and feedback at filmspotting.net is the email.
Margaret just doesn't miss performances. If she can walk, crawl, or roll, she plays. The show must go on. No, dear. Margot must go on.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater 1, in which I'm going to have to get very riled up for. Josh.
Yeah. Yeah. Get angry, frustrated.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm mad here.
I don't know.
I'm telling myself I'm mad here.
I don't know what I can do. I mean, I already denied a vote to, you know, Midnight Run in the Pantheon. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's enough to rile you up. You seem to be taking that in stride. So I'm trying to think what else I could do here.
I'll pretend you gave it 2.5 stars.
Okay.
How's that?
Whatever it takes. And no heart. No heart.
I'm going to start it off. You're going to give me the action. Are you ready?
Yes. And action.
Dirty old man.
What happened?
I just got pinched in the elevator.
Well, now you know how the other half lives.
Look at that. I'm not even pretty.
They don't care. Just as long as you're wearing a skirt. It's like waving a red flag in front of a bull.
Really? Well, I'm sick of being the flag. I want to be a bull again. Now, what do you say? Let's get out of here. Let's blow.
Go where?
You promise me, Joe, that the minute we hit Florida, we're going to beat it.
How can we? We're broke.
But we could find another band, a male band.
Look, stupid. Right now, Spats Columbo and his chums are looking for us in every male band in the country.
So humiliating.
So you got pinched in the elevator. So what? Would you rather be picking lead out of your navel?
And? Scene.
Scene.
I'd take the pinch, probably. Probably.
That was, you were irate.
Irate. Thank you. Then mission accomplished. If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback at filmspotting.net. The deadline is Monday, September 18th. We will select the winner randomly from all the correct entries and announce it in a couple of weeks.
We get into our African cinema marathon with some of the trailer for 1987's Yelen, directed by Suleiman Sisse. It's the fourth film in the marathon, a survey of some of the best movies produced by the continent from the 50s all the way into the 2010s. You can follow along at filmspotting.net/marathons. We started the marathon with a film from Egypt, 1958's Cairo Station, and followed that up with two from Senegal. Sisse is from Mali, a landlocked country in West Africa that is more than half desert. In 1974, Sisse made the first feature in the country's most commonly spoken language, Bambara. That film was Den Musso, which translates as The Girl. It was banned by the Malian government, and Sisse was imprisoned. Yelen came out in 1987. It played in competition at the Cannes Film Festival, won a special jury prize, which was the first prize of any kind awarded to an African film in the festival's history.
Yelen, which translates as brightness, is a coming-of-age story of sorts based on a Bambara legend. A father and practitioner of magic determines to kill his son when a prophecy suggests that his son will kill him. The son escapes and is pursued by his father through the desert. Along the way, the boy learns to practice magic himself. Throughout this marathon so far, Josh, we've seen neorealism and noir. We've seen parable and French New Wave-inspired experimentation. Yelen feels like something else entirely, and it also seems like the first film in the marathon that doesn't directly address its country's experience with European colonialism. Would you agree?
Yeah, that's what stood out to me the most after this first viewing. And of course, as you say, it is because of the context of the marathon, these other films we've chosen. So I don't know that this speaks, you know, overall to African cinema. But yeah, when we look at the other movies we've been watching here, there is no Western / European influence, really. It's purposefully free of that setting, free of those concerns, considering this is a film that came out in the 80s. So clearly is something that the movie could have addressed. It reminded me, you know, if you want to even call it like untouched, something like that. It reminded me of 2021's This Is Not a Burial, It's a Resurrection, which is a movie that I would recommend if any listeners have been enjoying this marathon and want to explore further and they have not seen that 2021 film. It's a fascinating one. It takes place in Lesotho, and it almost made my top 10 list that year. That film has, it has a somewhat similar mythological realm, but it's also rooted in and references the influence of European Christianity in This Is Not a Burial. So we don't have any of that even here in Yalén. I think there are two points I do want to mention, a couple points where you can still sense that, yes, this was made in the 80s, right? In a nation that does, on a continent that does bear that history. And think about that moment where we have Ninan Koro, the main character, on this hero's journey, and he is talking to his uncle, and he has his bride with him, Atu, at this point. And the uncle tells them their descendants will become slaves, mm-hmm. and other nations will come to plunder their land. So there you have it. There you have this movie, you know, made, a modern film made, but set centuries prior to enslavement and colonization, interestingly predicting that in a way. So that stood out to me, which I thought was, you know, just something unique for this film. But also, as I thought about it some more, there are touches of modernity in the soundtrack, which employs both the vocals of a Malian singer, Salif Kefta, but then you also have these jazz strains from a French musician, Michel Portal. So that's a mixture going on there. And then, of course, should also note that Cissé was working here with two French cinematographers, Jean-Noël Farragut and Jean-Michel Humeau. So obviously, as a movie made in the 80s, it's not going to be entirely free of that sort of context. But within the realm of this marathon, that's what made it an especially enthralling experience, I think, is to kind of be placed in that headspace mm-hmm. as much as this film could manage it and watch something that was intent on being, for lack of a different word, purely African in this specific sense, in this specific setting.
Yeah, I had the same reaction to it, where at first you're almost surprised, based on the other films we've seen in the marathon, to have a movie that doesn't seem to be explicitly wrestling with its history and these questions about how we as a country, how people as a collective and as individuals move forward. And then it really all does come together in that moment you describe, where you realize, even though this is this centuries old fable that's being told, there's a reason why it's being told. And no, it may not be about colonialism per se, but it's still very much about reckoning with a national trauma. It's just doing it in the form of wrestling with an eventual history, a known history in the case of the viewer, just not in the case of the subjects themselves. But it's being foretold in that way with this legend. And so this movie then takes on this, for me, this mythical status or this mode of storytelling, these mythical ideas of the father and the son clashing with each other. It takes on an Edenic quality for me. It's an origin story. This is an origin story of what is to become of this country and these people. And like you said, it feels like Cissé is doing it in a way that is appropriate for that material, which is to tell it from a uniquely African point of view, and not to ground the storytelling in any other conventions of other cinemas. All those other ones we noted in the setup there, we've seen these filmmakers tell very African stories and wrestle with questions that are urgent for the artists and the people of its time, but we've seen them do it in a way that we can wrap our heads around a little bit, or a little bit more easily. We know the conventions of these international cinemas and these different approaches that grounds us. We have none of that foundation for this film at all.
Yeah. It's at turns mystifying, but I didn't ever find it alienating, because it is operating in those universal thematic concerns. It also felt very much like an Arthurian legend. If you're familiar with how an Arthurian legend might function. And I think that's where this is interesting, too, to consider that it is a work of adaptation, right? This is an oral fable that had been passed down that is now getting a cinematic treatment. And I think you can see that in what the film chooses to spend time on and how faithful, not that I'm familiar with the original, you know, an original oral version, but how it chooses to be faithful in its own way and to just let these universal ideas percolate under the surface and let us sit in the texture of this story. I think that what Cisse is doing here is recognizing that he is working in a completely unique medium. And so what is not necessary is to hit all of the plot points specifically and explain everything. That's not what cinema can do uniquely. What cinema can do uniquely is capture mood and texture. I think for me, another standout quality to Yelen was the textures we get here. And that seems to be where the camera is drawn to, where it focuses on. I think of, you know, very early on where we see his father casting some sort of spell, this tower of fire that suddenly appears in front of him. So we have the flames, we have that texture, the texture of flame and fire. We have those visions we see early on in a bowl of water. And so we get that texture. How about the dry, cracked ground that Ninan Koro is walking across with his bare feet? We can feel the hardness and the crumbling of that when we see it. There's so many shots of trees. There's one of this enormous tree where its branches are just covering a number of people, almost enfolding them. We get his mother pouring water, more water over herself while standing among these reeds. And then those rock walls later in the film with their little cutouts. And these are the details that the camera seems to linger on. And again, there's no plot here. There's no storytelling here. But it is giving us the elements of this story that it probably has always had in a way now that only cinema could. That seemed to be a priority, perhaps, for the filmmakers.
Well, and amongst all those other textures, how about the textures of the faces we see in close-up? And how those are juxtaposed here with the animals that we see and some of these tokens and of nature in general. I want to give a little bit of a shout out here to our former PA, Andy Mitchell Gregory. He watched this in anticipation of the marathon and logged it on Letterboxd. And he said this: "The previous two films I've watched, Cairo Station and Black Girl, were partially about the influence of European colonialism on the culture and psychology of its African characters. Yelen is remarkable for the absolute zero concern it has for anything outside of its fable of a story. To read that it was, quote, in part made in opposition to European ethnographic films is so clear it almost goes without saying. The magic touches and comparably languid pace reminded me a little of Tarkovsky, which is to say it was disorienting and at times inscrutable first watch, but I'm eager to hear more context and analysis in the weeks to come." So I referenced that mainly first in terms of it being disorienting and at times inscrutable. This is one of those films that falls into that odd sort of category for me of being confusing and mystifying at times, to use your word, but also sneakily simple. And what I mean is every time I found myself going, I think this is what's happening right now. I'm not totally sure. But I think this is what these characters are up to and what they're after and why. I would think that. And then usually the next few minutes would bear that out and or seem to bear it out. And then at the end of the film, this is one of those movies where I go to Wikipedia and I read the plot synopsis just to see, okay, did I miss anything?
Yeah,
like,
sure.
Did I miss anything blatant here? And I found that everything I thought was happening was happening.
Yeah.
Did I take everything away from it that I could have or should have or would with more education? No, almost certainly not. But in terms of the events that are unfolding, even though they're not told in a completely straightforward way, and I think there's one major way it departs from being conventional storytelling that I'll get to, it actually isn't quite as confusing as maybe it could be. And I really like what Andy said, though, equating it to Tarkovsky. It helped me think about the movie a little bit, going back to our last marathon and Mirror. I think that that is a good place to start, at least with trying to figure out how to make sense of or how to watch and appreciate a film like this one. And you remember, Josh, that was a movie where we both commented on how, as much as we did really appreciate it, I think it was up there for both of us, if not the film of the marathon, it was close. We also acknowledged that it felt like it was so rooted in Russian history that without some of that context and background and knowledge, we did feel like we were missing out. And this film feels so rooted in the fables, in the history of this West African country, that surely watching it, we didn't quite take away everything or grasp on to all of the meaning that we could. And yet the pleasures of it were similar in terms of those textures and it drawing you in to pay attention to the imagery itself. And if Mirror was a movie that seemed like it was conjured or being conjured in real time from the mind of its creator, Yellen feels like it's springing from the collective unconscious of the Malian people. You know, and I say that, Josh, because of this is the key departure. Because of that decision to tell the story in a manner in which it gives equality to all of the characters, there is a much more Star Wars-esque and conventionally satisfying version of this story. And that is the one where it's a hero's journey, where it's about that character, moment to moment, trying to get to his destination, overcoming all of the obstacles and challenges in his way, it being truly that coming of age tale. And Sisse just eschews that completely and says, I may go from a moment of that character reckoning with his future and setting off on his journey, and then I may not come back to him for another 20 or 30 minutes because I'm going to go and bring in all of these other elements to the story that are going to give this world the textures that he's trying to apply.
Yeah, there's a long sequence with Soma, his father, played by Niamhanto Sanogo, which is, you know, proves your point that the film is very happy to go and sit with him for a while. I like the reference to Tarkovsky's Mirror in particular for the reasons you said, but also because it shares an interest in spirituality, which is very much imbued in this film as well. Spirituality, obviously, I'm completely unfamiliar with, and that is another area where you feel a little lost, a little at sea, but you sense, again, the experience of that, if not the details and what every reference or name means. And I talked about, you know, Mirror being one of these films that pierces the veil, you know, and I think that's the veil between what we think we know or what we can see and what might be beyond. That's what Tarkovsky does in general, Mirror does in particular, and I think that's what's happening here. It's also what's happening in This Is Not a Burial, It's a Resurrection, actually. That's another point of comparison between those two films. And one that came to mind that does something of this, not quite as extensive as all these other films, but was Julie Dash's Daughters of the Dust, which I believe we saw for a marathon as well. Now set, you know, in the United States, and but also incorporates African spirituality directly into what those characters are experiencing. And I felt similarly at sea during much of Daughters of the Dust, right? Where you're not all the references you're not getting, but you're understanding that film as well as this one puts you in that mind space of this experience, if not of a particular character, of this shared, to your point, spiritual experience that is taking place through within this otherwise hero's journey narrative.
Yeah. And that's another juxtaposition between the two films that I think you're getting at. There's this sort of ethereal but everyday magic that we see in Tarkovsky, these hints of possibilities, but still rooted in things that are real. The rings from the mug, the steam on the table, like we touched on, the wind blowing in a way that feels very familiar, but also kind of surreal or heightened. And here, despite it at times feeling, and Mirror never feels like this, at times feeling like it almost could be a documentary, that we're following a journey of a character, that we're being exposed to the customs of these people in this time, we also get actual magic in this film,
love,
right?
I love the, I guess you'd call it DIY pre-CGI way that the magic here is depicted using little in-camera tricks like the cut, that Tower of Fire I mentioned. I think that's just simply an imperceptible cut from the tower to when it's suddenly engulfed in flames, right? So something like that. Or the moment where characters, the film runs backwards to give them sort of a strange, eerie sensation. And maybe my favorite is when one character is, a spell is cast. Ninon Koro casts a spell to immobilize a warrior. And how do they convey that? Well, the guy just stands still and freezes. And there is something, there is an enchanting, especially in our drowning age of CGI, not completely anti-CGI, it has its purposes, but in an age when we're drowning in it, there's something enchanting and out of time to the way that Sisse is conjuring his own cinematic tricks here.
Yeah, including at the end when we get this showdown of sorts. And I should have looked this up before I even speculate, because someone's going to write in and tell me how off I am. But you're talking about those in-camera tricks. We get this moment of brightness, of light overtaking everything. And I wonder if they just opened up the iris and let all the light flood in and overexpose the frame, right?
Yeah, there's it seems else. Like something like that.
Yeah, yeah. There's certainly, or it seems anyway, like they're not doing some other kind of special effect that definitely wouldn't match the overall approach of this film. I did just notice a note I had written down, and I hadn't actually connected it to the talk of Tarkovsky until right now, but apparently Sisse was trained in the Soviet Union. So you wonder if maybe there really was some Tarkovsky influence that he was aware of or drawing on there with this film.
I mean, it would have been the same time period, right?
Yeah,
Tarkovsky would have been making films
in the 80s, in the decade before and in the 80s. So it seems like he might have been familiar with his work, even though I do want to be clear, I think he's doing something that is uniquely his own here. And if anything, it's more in how I'm processing the films and the approach than anything else. And can we laugh for a minute? I mean, we're having or trying to have a very serious conversation about a very serious film. But there is a moment that I just couldn't help but chuckle at, and I don't know why it's a line more people don't try to use, Josh. And who knows what the actual dialogue is versus the translation, but how about the moment where Ninon Koro has had that exchange with the king? The king sends him to go off with his youngest wife to work his magic to make her so she's not barren. And he works some magic, but that magic is they end up sleeping together. And when they get back, he's ashamed and he's hesitant. He doesn't want to tell the king what happened. And then how does he describe it? He says, "My penis betrayed me."
Betrayed. Betrayed. So that is the moment, we were watching this over the weekend in the afternoon. That's the moment our high school daughter walked in and just got one of these, "What? Are you watching?
Oh, you're going with that excuse?" Yellen is, as we mentioned earlier, tough to track down. Start with your local library and go from there. Absolutely worth seeing, and absolutely a film that is worthy of its status as a defining African cinema film, or at least having seen it and seeing it in the context of this marathon, you can understand why it's regarded that way. We'd love to hear your thoughts on it if you've seen it. feedback@filmspotting.net. I Am Not a Witch is up next. We encourage you to follow along at filmspotting.net/marathons. That's our show.
If you want to connect with us on social media, you can find us on Facebook, on Twitter, on Letterboxd. Please come talk to us on Threads. It's pretty dead there, so we'd love it if someone came and talked to us. Adam is at Filmspotting. I'm at Larson on Film. The current Film Spotting poll has us looking ahead to next week's Sacred Cow review of Richard Linklater's Dazed and Confused, which turns 30 this year. We're asking you to save a single Linklater movie. For show t-shirts or other merch, go to filmspotting.net/shop. And to support the show, you can join the Film Spotting family over at filmspottingfamily.com. For as little as $5 a month, you can listen to the show early and ad-free. Plus, you'll get a weekly newsletter and access to monthly bonus shows or the entire Film Spotting archive. Heck, I think you can even get both. That's an option too. All of that is at filmspottingfamily.com.
In limited release, you can see Fremont, about a former translator for the U.S. government in Afghanistan, living a quiet but unsettled life in Fremont, California. Our friend Mariah Gates saw it at Sundance. It's playing at the Music Box. Mariah said, it's hilarious dry humor and has so much heart. A true gem, she called it. Rotting in the Sun is the latest from director Sebastian Silva. He made Crystal Fairy and the Magical Cactus with Michael Cera, also Nasty Baby with Kristen Wiig. In wide release, you can see The Nun 2, My Big Fat Greek Wedding 3, and Aristotle and Dante Discover the Secrets of the Universe 4. No, I'm just kidding. There's
one.
No, there's no 4.
One.
Yeah, it's one. We'll see if we get four. That's a movie based on the 2012 award-winning YA novel. Next week, it is that final film in the African Cinema Marathon. If you've got a great title for the awards, share it with us. And Dazed and Confused at 30. It's coming next week.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgeren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistants are Betty Lavendero and Veronica Phillips. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.